Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, July 26, 2017. Civil society activists say excluding Riek Machar from the next IGAD meeting is a blunder.
People like Dr. Machar, Lam Akol, people like Cirilo are part of this process. Then this is a sign that this country is moving towards the path of stability.
And the UN says South Sudan government continues to block aid workers.
UN OCHA organized a convoy to come and deliver services here, more especially food stuff. They refused it to come in, and the non-food items by then was coming through Moyo. Also, it was blocked.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan civil society activists say the IGAD-led process to revive the 2015 peace deal will not succeed if principal signatories to the accord are blocked from attending the proposed IGAD forum for stakeholders of the 2015 agreement. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Ethiopian Foreign Minister Wakene Gebeyehu said at the end of Monday's IGAD Council of Ministers consultative meeting in Juba that exiled rebel leader Riek Machar will not be invited to the next meeting of stakeholders to the peace agreement.
We already agreed, not as the heads of the state, that in the process, all opposition groups, including Riek Machar's ideas, the representative of Riek Machar can be here, can be represented in this process. For the time being, physically, we are not inviting the Riek Machar.
But South Sudanese activists say the decision not to invite Machar is wrong and throws into question whether the regional bloc IGAD is operating as a neutral entity. Rajab Muhandis, executive director of South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, Osunde, says any revitalization process that excludes certain parties to the agreement risks restoring status quo in the country.
It will be very challenging if the peace agreement that is going to be revitalized does not adequately capture the challenges that we have and does not adequately include all the parties to the conflict. If half of the parties are included, others are not, there is a likelihood that those who may not be involved will still may not have other options but have violence as an option to find their ways to the political process.
At Monday's extraordinary meeting, IGAD's Council of Ministers passed a number of resolutions to revitalize the peace deal, such as bring all opposition stakeholders to the table. While the IGAD communique did not mention Machar by name, Gebeyehu made it clear he would not be invited to the next stakeholders' meeting. Another activist, Jame David Kolok, executive director for Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance, agrees with the Muhandis, saying excluding key leaders is not the way to go.
If there are every avenues through which people like Dr. Machar, Lam Akol, people like Cirilo are part of this process, then this is a sign that this country is moving towards the path of stability. So please, we are advising all parties responsible for bringing peace in this country, including the civil society, including the citizens of this country, that we must embrace and genuinely embrace inclusivity of everybody unless we are pretending.
David says it is high time IGAD leaders renew efforts to restore calm in South Sudan. Although he welcomes some contents of the IGAD resolutions passed on Monday, David says there is nothing new. David says the revitalization process should be seen as a window of opportunity for IGAD leaders to help put an end to the conflict, adding they have achieved little in the last 22 months.
We have seen emphasis being made in regards to this country is stopping the war. Emphasis being made in terms of the question of inclusivity, emphasis being met in terms of ensuring that there is respect for ceasefire. Unfortunately, time is going and these things are not being realized.
Chapter 2 of the peace agreement requires a permanent cessation of hostilities and addresses all security challenges which affect ordinary citizens. David says those key aspects of Chapter 2 have not been respected or implemented. Mohandis says the resolutions from the IGAD Council of Ministers do not outline the key problems that need to be fixed.
There are clear challenges to the implementation. There are clear causes for which South Sudan is in crisis. And we would love to see IGAD and its Council of Ministers coming out very clearly to outline the challenges, the issues.
JEMEC Chairman Festus Mohai, who briefed the Council on the current situation in South Sudan, said the revitalization process addressed the political realities in South Sudan and the forum should examine progress made in implementing the peace deal, determine impediments to progress, and seek concrete proposals to resolve those impediments. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says government forces continue to block aid agencies from accessing certain areas in South Sudan, despite assurances from senior government officials. OCHA's country director for South Sudan says aid agencies have been denied permission to deliver food to thousands of internally displaced persons in Kajokeji. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Ian Ridley, OCHA's country director for South Sudan, says military authorities have denied aid workers permission to access thousands of internal displaced persons in Kajokeji of Yei River State.
I can assure those 30,000 people that are in camps around Kajokeji and waiting for humanitarian assistance that humanitarian agencies are trying their very best to deliver that assistance. In fact, since the beginning of May, there have been several attempts to send a convoy of humanitarian aid from Juba to that area. Unfortunately, that convoy has been denied access.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Raikong denies the SPLA is blocking aid workers from accessing those in need of assistance. Last week, Kong told VOA that there are no IDPs in Kajokeji.
We do not have IDPs in rebel control areas. That's not completely correct. We know that we have South Sudanese refugees who crossed over to Uganda. They are mostly in Mangalatoria, on the Ugandan side of the border. So it's just another propaganda to fool the whole world that they have an area under their control with civilians. You know, it is a war of claiming populations, and it is not going to help them. That's not true.
The SPLA IO Commissioner for Yei River State's Kajokeji County, Kenyi Eresto Alia, said some aid organizations were willing to distribute food to IDPs in areas controlled by the SPLA IO. Eresto said the South Sudan government denied aid agencies access to rebel-held territories in Kajokeji.
UN OCHA organized a convoy to come and deliver services here, more especially food stuff. They refused it to come in. And the non-food items by then was coming through Moyo. Also, it was blocked.
Ridley says UN OCHA raised the issue with authorities in Juba last week to no avail.
Here in Juba, at the central level, we have many good channels of communication with the authorities. We have good relations and good conversations. Unfortunately, those conversations don't always deliver the outcomes that we want, as in this case. And I think often the reason for that is that access is denied by actors, often armed actors, at a checkpoint many kilometers away from Juba.
Ridley says OCHA continues to advocate for free and unfettered humanitarian access, including to thousands of people in desperate need of assistance across the country. He says aid workers hope they will be allowed access to areas where people are in desperate need of assistance soon, regardless of their ethnic background.
I think the people that are stopping humanitarian access would want to understand that the role of humanitarians in South Sudan is to serve all South Sudanese that have needs. We do that without regard to where those people are based or where they're from. It's really based on their humanitarian needs alone, and we appeal to all actors, therefore, to respect humanitarian organizations wanting to deliver aid purely based on need.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir has repeatedly assured aid workers of unimpeded access to civilians trapped by fighting between rebel and government forces in parts of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The Egyptian government is calling on South Sudanese warring parties to end the nearly four-year conflict. Egypt's outgoing ambassador to South Sudan, Ayman al-Jamal, says his government supports the national dialogue and IGAD-led plans to revive the peace agreement. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Speaking in Juba on Tuesday, marking Egyptians' National Day, Ambassador al-Jamal said widespread insecurity has hampered his country from implementing developmental projects in South Sudan for the past 4 years.
Egypt, since the start of the crisis in December 2013, stressed the importance of stopping all hostilities. And we were among the first countries to respond by providing medical and humanitarian assistance to South Sudan. We also supported all the peace initiatives and endeavors by the region and the African Union. We declared our full support to both the SPLM reunification efforts and the Addis Ababa negotiation that materialized in the signing of the Arusha Agreement and the ARCCS.
Al-Jamal says South Sudan can achieve real peace if its leaders show a strong political will to resolve their differences peacefully. He says Egypt supports the proposed national dialogue, but also thinks the peace deal should be resuscitated and fully implemented.
I certainly believe that dialogue is the only way to get South Sudan out of war, and I'm sure that the comrades of arms and struggle will understand this for the sake of their own people. I hope that the perils and destruction and suffering of the citizens of South Sudan will be a strong catalyst that will push all parties to reach a lasting solution that will put South Sudan back into its track for stability, social and economic development.
Al-Jamal says his country stands ready to implement electricity and irrigation projects once South Sudan's leaders restore peace in the country. Egypt has already constructed 3 technical schools in Wau, Juba and Bor, and is expected to open a branch of Alexandria University in South Sudan's Tonji State soon. The Egyptian government has also offered 300 undergraduate scholarships for South Sudanese to study in Egyptian universities and colleges every year for the past 4 years. South Sudan Education Minister Deng Hoch praised the Egyptian government's role in helping to develop the country's education sector.
We need every little support we can get from old friends to address the current humanitarian situation as well as implementation of the agreement and the National Dialogue Initiative. Our president, our first vice president, and our vice president have committed themselves to peace. And we are all working hard to implement the peace agreement and ensure peace prevails everywhere in South Sudan.
Hoch noted Egypt and South Sudan have signed a number of cooperation agreements in the past.
A number of legal instruments, cooperation agreements, and memoranda of understanding have been signed and are being implemented. So our relationship is getting stronger, and we'll do our best to keep it that way.
Last month, Egypt donated hundreds of tons of relief items, including medicine, food, and non-food items to South Sudanese needy. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, age limit is dominating debates in neighboring Uganda. Find out why when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is paying dowry a social necessity or an obstacle to marriage?
Although I don't think it's absolutely necessary, I think it's very important to symbolize you being able to provide for a family that you want.
I don't think it is an obstacle because, first of all, paying dowry, it's still the relationship between the two partners. Especially when you paid dowry to your in-laws, they have to respect you much. So if you have not paid any dowry, then people will not give you that respect.
Because if you love someone, you're willing to pay whatever price it is as a sign of appreciating.
I think it's a social necessity, and it's also not an obstacle. Make the society aware that I have taken this woman as my wife.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Uganda's parliament is considering an amendment to the country's constitution on land issues. Another proposed revision, which is not on the table, is sparking a serious debate. Halima Athumani has details for VOA from Kampala.
Uganda's constitution sets the age range for president at 35 to 75 years of age. Born in 1944, President Yoweri Museveni will be 76 years old at the next elections in 2021. That means after 3 decades in power, he will not be eligible to stand for re-election. But Deputy Attorney General Mwesigwa Rukutana has discussed amending the constitution. The public reacted quickly, urging legislators not to touch Article 1 or 2, Section B. Ruling Party MP David Abala explains.
The first thing that was done was to make sure all our telephone contacts are thrown to the Facebook. Anybody can say anything. So as members of parliament, who have been described as gluttons. They say members of parliament have been paid $107. And some of them are calling me. They hire arresters. They say, we trust you, but please, no, do not tamper that Article 102 about age limit.
No amendment to the age limit has been put before parliament, but that has not stopped the opposition. Last week, Democratic Party President Norbert Mao and some members of his party marched to the Constitutional Square to hang a banner. Mao and 14 other people were arrested. They were released later, the same day.
Our slogan, if you dare and touch it, meaning that provision of the Constitution, there will be a reckoning. This is the last barricade against life presidency. It is the last defense against Museveni's family's despotic ambitions. We had the term limits. The term limits were removed. We thought this one now would not be able to be removed. It turns out the age limit is also a false bottom because it will not hold Museveni.
The president's supporters also sprang into action. Presidential advisor on political affairs Devin Mafabi held a meeting for ruling party youth leaders, legislators and academics. He told VOA they are launching a countrywide campaign to lift the presidential age limit. President Museveni has defended Mafabi, saying his advisor was provoked.
I hear that there is a debate about age limit and I don't know what. What are you debating? Who has brought a proposal? So those indisciplined people, they should know that there will be counteraction, political action, because if you play games, the other side will react. So you shouldn't waste your time with people who have no work to do.
Museveni has not said whether he supports lifting the age limit. Opposition legislator Semuju Nganda of the Forum for Democratic Change says this is characteristic of the president.
He will act through proxies. So therefore, this is a legitimate matter. So even if Museveni wanted or he didn't want, this is the right time for Uganda to begin discussing the transition either from Museveni to Museveni or transition from Museveni to another person.
Only the Attorney General can introduce a constitutional amendment to Parliament. The proposed amendment on land rights is currently before a parliamentary committee. The Attorney General's office has not said whether it will propose any further amendments to Parliament at this time. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Science seemed to be finally starting to win the war against the human immunodeficiency virus that causes AIDS. But experts gathered at the Paris conference on the deadly disease say proposed cuts in global funding may delay the final blow. VOA's George Puttich reports.
It took 3 decades from the appearance of the first drug for slowing the onset of AIDS to today's drug cocktails that save many of the infected patients from what was inevitable death. The conference on AIDS held this week in Paris reflected optimism about new treatments and concern about proposed cuts in funding, especially by the U.S. government. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo highlighted the lack of funds.
I want to remind you that $7 billion per year is still missing in the fight against AIDS in the world. This is the money we need to find. And thanks to our mobilization, we could assign it to the fight against AIDS.
In spite of the latest advances, the virus that causes AIDS remains a formidable enemy due to its unprecedented ability to develop resistance to drugs. New medicines keep it under control, but they are neither available nor affordable for many. Experts, such as the president of the International AIDS Society, Linda Gale Becker, also suspect a large number of unreported cases.
We know we're treating 19.5 million people, but there's another 17-odd million who need treatment today. And we haven't found those people. Many of them are in regions of the world such as West Africa, Central Africa, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, that we haven't got to. So that's very concerning.
However, UNAIDS Executive Director Michelle Sibide sounded an optimistic note.
We are reaching the people in need. We are saving lives because it's not only about proving that we can put people under treatment, but also that we needed to completely change the screening.
Among the highlights is the recent news about a 10-year-old South African child born with HIV. After only a year of treatment, the child has been virus-free for more than 8 years. Citing other similar cases, as well as the promising vaccines being developed, experts say the scales may finally be tipped against the disease that so far has killed about 35 million people. George Puttich, VOA News, Washington.
As World AIDS experts announce promising gains in Paris, in northern Cameroon, identifying and treating HIV-positive mothers and babies remains a challenge. Muki Edwin Kinzeka has this story from Yaoundé.
Hundreds of people have gathered here at the Yerwa Junction in northern Cameroon to listen to people living with HIV. Among the speakers is Miriam Anna, who lost her husband and 3-month-old baby 2 years ago.
Ceux qui sont dans la zone rurale, quand tu essaies même de les convaincre, plutôt la personne se dit que c'est.
She says when she tries to convince sick villagers to go with their babies for HIV screening, they argue they are bewitched by their relatives. She says she knows 3 men who died of HIV and their wives have refused to take their babies to the hospital, claiming the families are suffering from a spell. Miriam did not have prenatal care. She delivered her baby at a traditional birth attendant's home. It was only after, when she became sick, that she went to a hospital and found out she had HIV. She is now a peer educator working as part of an initiative of the Cameroonian government. In 2016, the government found 7 out of 10 women in the northern part of the country were not visiting hospitals when they were pregnant. The government reports about 1/3 of those who did go to hospitals never showed up for their postnatal visits, even if the woman had tested positive for HIV. The job of the new peer educators is to identify pregnant women in their villages and encourage them to get medical care, even reminding them of their hospital appointments. The government says since the start of the program, 7 out of 10 pregnant women identified by peer educators now visit a hospital. The results of a mother's HIV test take just a day to be known, but newborns need a special screening, and the blood work can only be processed 1,000 kilometers away in the capital Yaoundé, says Wekan Georgette, in charge of HIV control and people living with AIDS department in Cameroon's Ministry of Health.
Les échantillons partaient de l'extrême nord pour Yaoundé.
She says it takes between 6 and 7 months for the results to be brought back from Yaoundé, and that at times the results come when some of the babies are already dead. She says they also face a specific problem of women in the north not returning with their babies for the follow-up appointments for fear of stigma. The UN Children's Fund estimates that in northern Cameroon, 40% of HIV-positive children do not receive treatment. Health officials say it is important to begin regular ARV treatment as soon as possible after diagnosis. In northern Cameroon, parents can take their children to Garowa for treatment, but the medical officer in charge of the hospital, Mireille Yaki, says there is a regular shortage of drugs.
À certains moments, changement de protocole. Bon, on met un enfant sous un protocole.
She says they regularly run short of antiretrovirals, and many parents will stop bringing their children for treatment along the way. The government of Cameroon has begun trials with new testing machines to reduce the time parents have to wait for a baby's test results. While ARV treatment is provided for free, patients are requested to pay for laboratory tests. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Gidé, Cameroon.
And that report by Kinzeka brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Hasada Maako by Isaka Number One.
Isaka Number One.
We have been listening to Isaka Number One with the song Hasada Maako. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.